into our hands. And so now, and we're going to try to cover Joshua 3 through 5, or at least most of 5, and look at the preparations being made for conquering the Canaan land, or the land, the promised land. I had a dream last night that I was supposed to be teaching, and I got a little confused, and the passage I was supposed to be teaching from was Snoopy 5-7. So if I get a little off track, just assume that I've gone over to Snoopy 5-7, but hopefully I can stay focused where we are today instead. But as we start into Joshua chapter 3, I think this is a very powerful verse, a very powerful chapter, again, with God demonstrating his power to his people. When they had gone through the wilderness, and they had what we call the wilderness wanderings, God always gave them something to follow. What did they have to follow in the wilderness? All right, so he gave them a visual, basically, cue of, you follow this. As they're getting ready to enter the land, he gives them something different to follow as they're about to cross the Jordan. What does he have them follow here? What goes before them into the Jordan?
The Ark.
The Ark of the Covenant. So again, they've got something physical to follow. They've got something that they can see that they are to go after, and they're going to see, and I think it's going to show God's power and him showing that, hey, I'm with you, and my power represented by this ark is taking care of you and is doing all these great wonders. So this is the passage or the chapter where the Israelites crossed the Jordan. And I always thought it was interesting that the Red Sea, the crossing of the Red Sea, is probably one of the most well-known stories from the Bible. Now, this is a very similar situation, I think, but I'd say like maybe 2% of the people who know about the crossing of the Red Sea actually know about the crossing of the Jordan. Part of that's probably because there's no army behind them that's about to get crushed. People seem to like destruction. But really, it's a very similar story. And God's going to say why he's doing these things. Verse 5. It says, Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. So again, we think about the reason that these things happen. And a lot of it is God still trying to convince his people of his power and that he is with them, that he's going to take care of them. And so Joshua says to the priests, you know, go take this ark and cross over ahead, basically making preparations. I like what verse 7, what God says to Joshua. He says, the Lord said to Joshua, this day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that you may know that just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. So what's God say he's doing here for Joshua? All right. So he's going to make sure that they recognize that, you know, Joshua is someone they should follow. Joshua has been elevated by God. I think it's interesting when we look at what Joshua says to the people as he's kind of repeating this account in verses 9 and 10. He says, then Joshua said to the sons of Israel, come here and hear the words of the Lord your God. Joshua said, by this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will assuredly dispossess from before you the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Hivite, the Perizzite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, and the Jebusite. So what does Joshua say that God is going to do? Yeah, and what he's about to do is to prove to them that he's going to drive them out. So that you shall know that he's among you. Now, what did God tell Joshua? Yeah, that they'll know that I'm with you. Joshua doesn't see a need to elevate himself. I think that's a very, very interesting point here, that even though God has told him this is going to take place, he doesn't feel a need to kind of lord that over them or try and lift himself up to say, hey, you watch what's going to happen. God's lifting me up. You know, he doesn't have that attitude that it is about him or the need to elevate himself. God's told him that, and I think he believes that, but he sees something more important here. And that's that they can recognize not just that God's with me, but that God is with us. So I really like that part of this section. Yeah, I think, and we probably recognize, people seem to have a pretty short memory. People forget about what's happened 2 weeks ago. All they can think about is what has just happened. And God, you know, doesn't give them a chance to forget about him. As we see, even when he's right with them, they'll forget about him. But he does constantly remind them that he's there and that he has the power. And again, I can understand, the people needed to have boldness and confidence in what they were about to do, because it was a great undertaking. I mean, anytime you're planning to go to battle, and you're planning to go try and overthrow a whole nations of people, if you feel like, well, we can't do this, well, we saw what happened, and it led to 40 years of wandering. So he makes sure he continually affirms to them, hey, we're going to be able to do this. I'm going to drive these people out. Joshua points out, he says, he will assuredly dispossess them. He doesn't say that he's doing this so you can recognize that you'll dispossess them, but he always keeps God in the focus. And when that happens, the people are successful. I think it is when people start to think it's about what they're doing or what they're accomplishing is when troubles come, when we forget about God. And I don't think that's just then. I think that's through all times. I think that's applicable for us as well. Yeah.
One thing about Joshua, I don't know that in my reading of these in the past few weeks that I've ever seen him be doubtful. Even Moses had some doubt, especially when God was trying to tell him he was going to be the leader. He was like, oh, no, send somebody else. One thing about Joshua is he has never seemed to waver in his belief that come what may, I believe God will. There may be 10 times the people of us, but where God is concerned, he will prevail. And it just seems like, thus far, I think I'm about chapter 22. So far, he hasn't, seemed to waver too much. I mean, sometimes Moses wavered a little bit, and especially early on, Moses didn't want to do it. He wanted somebody else to go. Yeah. He was not a good speaker, he said. But, Joshua, he just seems to always keep that faith, knowing that wherever God is concerned, he'll prevail.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think we do see such a great example in Joshua and his confidence in God and his, like you said, unwavering confidence. Moving forward, we see what happens when the priests who are carrying the ark step into the Jordan. All right, I think this is just crazy to picture. But they've got the ark, and they step in, and basically it seems like they're just ankle deep in it. It says that the waters have overflowed, or flooded this time of year. They're always kind of over the bank. So they've just stepped into this water, and the waters just wall up to the north. And it says not just right where they are, but it says in verse 16, the waters which were flowing down from above stood and rose up in one heap a great distance away at Adam. And I looked at some maps, and it's not right there, but it's hard to get a good gauge. It wasn't just this little area that was open that they walked through, but it walls up here, and then the picture I see is, the rest of it runs on away. So what does it say? What do they cross over on? Dry ground. Now, I think that could indicate just that there's no standing water there, but I think if you think about where water has been, it's probably not easy terrain to cross over. Marshy, muddy, it would be, just because the waters weren't there anymore, I think it would not be easy to get hundreds of thousands of people across this. And again, we need to remember that it's not just the always the healthy people going through, but everybody, God is carrying with them. So it says dry ground. So to me, I picture that even more more of a miracle, not just that the waters had stopped, but even the ground dried up before them is how I take that to be, to give them an easier surface to get across here.
The King James says that they passed clean over. You know,
yeah.
I don't think that means, you know, clean over.
Right.
I think that they came out clean, meaning that it wasn't
yeah.
muddy.
You yeah.
know, but kind of the way I think.
So, I mean, again, this is just such a fantastic miracle. But why would he have stopped the waters a great distance away? I can think of at least two reasons.
They're going to need a decent-sized path to go through.
That's true.
That would be
you've got a lot of people, so again, the water...
It's
the,
not going to be like a little narrow path. That
yeah. Yeah. Why else?
Well, this was a miracle. I mean, it wasn't like it was a wind that came by.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what are miracles typically done for? Yeah, to confirm God's power, to confirm the word of whoever's speaking it. And so he's already told these people, I'm doing this to prove to you that I'm God. But who else does this prove his power to?
Scares the people on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah, when we get over a couple chapters, we're going to see that their response as a result of this was... Wow, you know, their hearts melted again. The same thing it talked about in chapter 2. And so if the water is way up there, then all the people along the Jordan, anywhere south of that, and it may have messed things up to the north too. I don't know what they're seeing. If the waters quit flowing, they might be like, something's weird here. But definitely the people south of that point along the Jordan are seeing, this isn't right. You know, this is not natural what's happening here. And the word spreads to them as well that this God who's done all these other things they've heard about, you know, he's right here. He's on our doorstep. You know, we heard about what he did in Egypt, but we can still maybe, well, that was far away. Maybe he's the God of that area. But now, right on their doorstep, right outside their nation or their land, God's still proving his power. And so he's preparing the people to have confidence, but preparing those of the land to have the dread and the fear of what's about to come. So I think, again, we see just the power of these miracles. Anyone else have any thoughts before we move into chapter 4?
The people in Jericho could see it.
Yeah.
It was that close to them, so they're the immediate.
Yes. Yeah, no, there's no doubt about whether or not they're seeing it. They definitely are recognizing that this is coming toward them. Chapter 4, what's kind of the main theme of chapter 4? What's the big thing that's done here? All right, they set up a memorial of the stones. Now, without getting into too much detail of this, based on how you read chapter 9 or verse 9, there were either one or two memorials. And I still don't know which way I think it is. If you just straight up read it literally, there are two. But it might be just implying that the stones came from where the priests were and were put up in Gilgal. So who was supposed to take these stones?
One member of each tribe.
All right. Again, what does that kind of bring our mind back to? When was there one member of each tribe that was sent to do something? The spies, back in Numbers. So maybe, again, we're trying to get redemption for the tribes. We're trying to, you know, everybody is a part of this. And also, you know, we recognize we do see, especially moving forward, we see divisions among the tribes. And eventually there's a huge division where it's split in half. But I think there should have been unity. And so this is trying to show that unity that should be there, because this is all the promised people, all the children of promise. So one man from each tribe goes and grabs a stone, and then they go back across and set them up. So they set up this memorial, and a couple places it talks about it. What was the purpose of this memorial?
So their children would not forget.
Yeah, what's the purpose of every memorial?
To not forget.
And yeah, he specifically says... here and other places, but for this memorial, so your children don't forget. Why is that significant? Yeah, That's a very important thing. That's the reason that we study the Bible, and the reason we study history class is you need to learn. And what's different about the children than them?
They're going to forget about a lot of that stuff. So this has to be a reminder.
Yeah, I mean, these people are seeing it.
Right.
You know, the people carrying it across, the people walking across, they were a part of it. So it's still, they would need a reminder, but they don't need to be taught about it. They don't need to be taught what happened here. But for the children, they didn't see this. They didn't know what had happened. And so we can easily get caught up in forgetting to teach important things. And so basically it points out, you know, when they see this, he's going to ask, what are these? Why are there these stones here? Children ask a lot of questions. Seems to be pretty standard for most children. So they see something, they're like, well, why is that? And so perfect lead-in to the parents to be able to explain, to teach about this, what had just happened, so that they also will recognize that God is the one who has given them this land. This was a promise from a long time back, and so they are recipients of this promise, but kind of the further away you get from being a part of taking the land, then the maybe less you would remember it. Yeah.
It's kind of like those emblems. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why did you get to have juice and a cracker? You know, and you explain it,
yep.
And we've all done it with our children, and it'll continue to be. We weren't there to see it happen, but we can still teach that it happened with those.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it serves both of those purposes. It reminds the one who sees it, but also it instigates that spark for teaching. Very important things. It does, in this chapter, make a special note of some people who also go across. Who does it point out specifically that crossed the river? Well, in verse 12.
Children of Reuben and the Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh, because they had already bargained for land on the other side.
Yeah, so they'd already made this promise, and we looked in Deuteronomy about how God, Moses told Joshua, hey, you make sure this happens. And then in Joshua 1, he reminds them, hey, we're doing this, and here we see it actually does take place. So again, just a reminder of that, and to show that it actually is fulfilled the way that it should be. And I think a lot of times, and it took me a while to appreciate this, but in the Bible, a lot of times, it tells this is going to happen, and then a little bit later it says, and it happened. And it seems kind of repetitive because it's all, I mean, sometimes it seems even word for word. But I think the importance of that is when it's from God, it proves that, you know, what he said happened. And here it's to show that the people were following what God had said. So I'm starting to try to appreciate that more and more, where we do see that repetitiveness. It's not just to repeat, but it's to emphasize that what was to take place did take place. And so we'll see that more often as we move forward.
Clark,
yeah.
Do you struggle any with the fact that, you know, God had prepared this promised land? It was on the other side of the river, but yet they wanted to settle for this over here. I mean, I know he okayed it.
Yeah. Right.
But then I know they had cattle, and that was good pasture and everything, but I still...
Yeah, and I think, and I'd have to look back at when they actually make that kind of deal, but I feel like Moses wasn't super thrilled with it either. So, yeah, it did almost show a lack of trust in that... And again, there's a couple of reasons they may have done that. One, some people may have thought...
It could be the size of everybody.
Yeah. Well, I mean, almost like... I feel like Moses is thinking, you all don't even want to come help take over the land, so you're just trying to cop out and say, oh, well, we've done enough. And so he emphasized that, and then they're like, oh yeah, we'll do that, we weren't saying that. No, kind of defend themselves a little. Well, now, you know what, that might be true. You know, you keep your whining over here, and we'll go on. No. But yeah, I think that is an issue. And another issue we're going to see is, and it's hard to pinpoint exactly, but they never really take over all the land that was promised to them. They never quite drive out the people of some of the cities. We see the Philistines especially, and are going to come up and be thorns in their sides for till the nation no longer exists in its independent form. But yeah, the taking over the land was not perfect, and so we're going to see the good part of it here in Joshua, and then if you were to keep going into Judges, you'll see kind of the bad part of it. But anyone else have anything from chapter 4? All right, moving into chapter 5. Verse 1 kind of reemphasizes what we were talking about earlier. It says, "Now it came about when all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the sons of Israel until they had crossed, that their hearts melted and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the sons of Israel." So again, there's no doubt that this God that's with Israel has more power than anything that they can imagine, than their power or whatever their gods they might think had power. This God with Israel is just so much greater that they had basically no chance to stand. They didn't think they could stand before them. Their hearts melted. I think that's just such a kind of a powerful phrase. No more courage. They knew they couldn't stand. So now they have to make preparation to go into the land, and there's a couple things that they do to prepare themselves. What's the first thing they do in chapter 5? All right. All the men are circumcised. Now, it kind of points out who was circumcised when they left Egypt. Yeah, it says the adult males, when they left Egypt, had been circumcised. But the males in the wilderness who grew up, they hadn't done it. There's a couple reasons that may have happened. We don't really know for sure. It could have been that they were just very lax in doing what they should have done. Wouldn't be the first time they didn't do what they should have done. It also may have been to set up this point, to set up this situation. So I don't know which of those it would be. But why would it be significant that they were circumcised before they went into the land?
Mm-hmm. It goes back to Abraham.
Yeah.
Promise.
Yeah.
Set apart the special people, and part of that was given the sign of circumcision.
Yeah, what's about to be fulfilled?
The promise of Abraham.
Yeah. A huge part of the promise to Abraham is about to be fulfilled. And what was the sign of the covenant? The circumcision. So it's them preparing themselves again in that covenant before God gives them what's been promised. And again, sometimes we have requirements. We might have to have someone sign a document before we can tell them something. And so it's kind of that same, proving, yes, you have to do this. It wasn't that allowed God to have any power, but God said, this is the sign, this is the covenant. So you have to accept that covenant before the promise is going to be fulfilled.
With any covenant, which is a contractor's condition, you have to meet those conditions or the contractor's void.
Yep. Yeah, it makes sure it points out that they recover before they go in, before they go any further. So that's, I think, a very important thing that takes place. And then what's the other thing that takes place before they go in?
Passover.
All right, they take of the Passover. Why is that a big deal?
And Israel at that time, and they're just being reminded of all that the Lord has done for them.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing, is you kind of see here, you can look at it two different ways, and I think both of them are helpful. You can look at it as, what did they do right like at the very start of their journey leaving Egypt? Was they remember the Passover. And right as they follow that, they cross the Red Sea. Then you've got all this period of wandering, and then it kind of is again, the bookend to that. At the end of this, they cross the Jordan, and then they partake of this feast, the Passover. So it's almost like that was the start of the journey, and that's the end of the journey. Or you can look at it, and I actually kind of like to look at it this way, that, well, the start of their exodus was taking the Passover, and now what's the start of their taking over the land? The start of their inheriting the promise is taking this Passover. The Passover was very significant, probably the most significant feast or memorial in Judaism or for the Israelites. And so it was really the start of them becoming a nation, kind of that prelude to it. Then it's the
story. That's also ended too, that they had there. That was the manna.
Yes. Yeah.
Some of them may have been glad about that. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll look at that in just a second. But while we're talking about the Passover, so it often has kind of been the precursor to very significant events throughout the history of God and his people. What's another example of that? What else was a significant event that happened right after Passover?
Jesus.
When was his crucifixion and resurrection? It was, basically during the Feast of Passover. And what did that start? Yeah, that started a new covenant, started Christianity. So the Passover, I think their remembrance here, again, God is setting their minds on what they're about to do, on what has happened and on who he is and then on what's about to happen. And so there is nothing just kind of random or nothing lacking in their preparation for taking this land. God has thoroughly prepared them, made sure that they were prepared in everything to be able to do this. And then what Doug also said is what did they finally get to eat?
Something besides manna.
It says, on the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. It says, the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land, so that the sons of Israel no longer had manna. You know, they finally made their way into the land, and they're starting to get to enjoy the fruits of the land. And that was one of the things that they said about it. You know, what do they call the land?
Milk.
Yeah, a land flowing with milk and honey. So we have to, I would assume that the produce here of the land was very good. And we think about the spies, the grapes that they had to like carry over the shoulders of two men, the big vines. So they finally are getting to enjoy, start to enjoy the fruits of this promised land.
That's pretty much all that this generation has known was the quail and the manna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that they found some places along their travels that had something to eat, but most of their diet had to do with manna and quail. You know, for this, that would be like, you know, a whole new smorgasbord.
That, yeah, I mean, that's, you're right.
They had some that actually tried to put some in their pocket. God told them only take what they needed to eat. Some of them tried to put it in their pocket and turned it into wishy-washy. But I guess once they got to Jordan, they were even better, so they were fine.
Yeah, now, yeah, they're ready. They're ready to enjoy it. It says they ate some of the yield of the land of Canaan during that year. And another thing to kind of think about here is, how much work did they do for the produce of the land that they were about to eat? Huh?
It was already.
Yeah, they didn't do anything. So just because God wasn't sending manna to rain from heaven, he's still providing for them. I think that's kind of what's emphasized there is they ate some of the yield of the land of Canaan during that year. Not that they've worked for, not that they've earned, but God is still providing for them. He didn't just cut off the manna and say, all right, now you're on your own. You've got to figure out what to do. But there, he had food prepared for them when that took place.
No,
You don't think we couldn't just walk to Save a Lot and have enough food for all these people?
You couldn't go to Cobra's and Save a Lot for a long way.
But I think you're exactly right. I mean, that's, you know, it's not just 5 of us or even 40 of us walking into a place and having enough food, but it's enough food for thousands, for tens or hundreds of thousands of people to have food. And again, I think we get the picture that there's plenty of food. It's not like they were barely scraping by. They just had enough to get by. I don't think we ever really see that picture from them. So God, even... maybe in a miraculous way, or maybe not exactly, but God still made sure that preparation was made. And again, I think that kind of points to the way we need to look at things, is sometimes things are set up for us maybe not as a miracle. Maybe it's something that we don't recognize or God has doing things, but God takes care of his people in ways that is needed. And so when the time came, when they needed to have proof of who he was, he did that. But here, I mean, I kind of wonder if they would have even recognized, if they would have thought about, you know, God's providing for us. At this time, maybe, because it seems like they're doing pretty well here. But I know a few down the road, we're going to see they don't have any appreciation for what God has given them and what God's prepared for them.
We fall into that, too, mm-hmm. because
We go to the grocery store, I want corn flakes.
Yeah.